Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Hello, this is Shireen.
Hi, this is Anna.
And this is Ethnically Ambiguous. We've had one of the best conversations today with, I hope to be a good friend of this person eventually. Eric Owusu is here with us today.
Interesting you say one day a good friend. It seems like you guys were doing just fine in the friend department.
We're on our way.
Thank you, Eric.
There you go.
I did just meet him last month. That's the only thing. Like, it's one thing for me to be like my great friend, even though we just met last month. But I feel a kinship already. We talk about so many things. He's an incredible person. We talk about how his parents tricked him into spending a year in Ghana, what it's like developing an accent and trying to lose it. We talk about how he got into comedy, his love for art, and how he paints, and then an incredible art project he made in college, and so many other things. It's such a beautiful conversation. Stay tuned.
Who are we? Where do we come from? Who do we become? What is it to be? What to be is it? Where are we? Who are my parents? Where are my pants? Why were we born? We are Ethnically Ambiguous.
Okay, let's do it. I'm starting the episode like this. Hi, Anna.
Hi, Shireen. Happy International Women's Day.
All right. We are recording this on March 8th. That is correct. Monday, March 8th, International Women's Day.
I would love to wish you a happy International Women's Day.
Women's Day. Hard H. There's no H in that word. How are you this Monday?
You know, just true violence on my body on this Women's Day. My period started. I have a migraine all day. I can't get it to go away. I actively decided not to smoke weed before this recording, even though I was like, should I just do it and just be useless? But I took a step back, looked within myself, and realized I am the worst when I'm high on these shows because I'm just like, duh, the whole time, which is truly my favorite self. What am I denying?
I don't think
myself?
You're the worst. I think it's an, I mean, I feel like if you're high, you might be more in your head than not, but
I think
you're great.
I'm not one of those any smokers. I'm not in my head ever. I've smoked weed for 40 years at this point. I've never been in my head with weed. I'm always like, I'm a little too out of my head, which is the problem. Like I'm too open with people knowing how high I am, and that's a problem.
Well, you know what? I respect it. We got to do what we got to do to cope, you know? And it's a good coping mechanism.
Oh, also my fridge broke, but
oh no.
I'm going to kill everybody.
Did a lot of food go to waste? That's sad.
Some food went to waste that I'm not happy about, but don't worry.
Aww. That sucks.
Don't worry, I found the one empty apartment in my building and I'm using that fridge until they'll just give us that fucking fridge, which they haven't yet.
Well, I hope you get a new
violence.
Fridge very
there
soon.
There will be violence.
But yeah, we're joined today by a guest that I'm really excited to have on. I met him last month at the same show I met a previous guest of the show that you've probably already heard by now, Dahlia Malik. She and I and this next guest met at the Your Late Night Tonight talk show with the host Fiza Dasani, and she brought us both on.
Nice.
And we met, and he's great. I'm so excited to talk to him. It's Eric Owusu.
Hi. Hey, everybody.
Welcome to our show.
I said that there was a live studio audience.
Yeah, I like that energy you brought in.
Oh, thank you.
You're hilarious, and I'm just glad that you're on the show. Honestly, Fiza was the only person I knew on that show. So I'm just grateful that I got to meet all of you. You guys were all amazing.
Yeah, they assembled a really good crew for that show. And it was fantastic doing the show and working and writing with you and everybody else. And coincidentally, I got home today and the drugs shirt I ordered as a gift for Fiza was in my mailbox. So
amazing.
Nice.
Amazing.
And how do you know Fiza?
Oh, we go way back to like 2015 when I moved here. She and I wrote for the CBS Diversity Showcase, which was a fun, joyous nightmare. But yeah. It brought a lot of us together. We were all in the trenches together. And, you know, it helped get me started here in my time in L.A. So she was acting for it and then also writing for it. And we met like in the basement of CBS Radford and we're like, are you cool? I'm cool. You're cool. I'm cool. Let's write together. And then nice. Yeah, after that, we like, she does stand up. I've been doing stand up a while and we started doing and hosting stand up shows together. So that's the homie.
She's incredible. Mm-hmm. Also a previous guest of the show. She's just so nice and so giving with her time and her energy and like truly someone out there that's like for the people. Like she really does root for other people and lift them up. And I really appreciate her so much. And honestly, working on that show with her and all of you guys just made me love her even more. She's truly the best.
Yeah. She's an angel and a gem and we don't deserve her. Ugh.
Bless Fizza Dasani.
Yeah.
But okay, the show isn't about Fizza. All right.
It's not. Wow. I'm leaving. I'm done.
Bless her, but get her out of here.
No, all love over here. But let's talk about you a little bit. Okay, let's rewind. Genuinely, all I know about you is that you're funny. So this is going to be news to me. But tell us where you were born and where you grew up.
Yeah, I'm from Maryland, born and raised in, Montgomery County, but raised in Prince George's County. For anyone outside of Maryland, everyone's like, what the fuck is the difference between those two counties I've never heard of in a state that I only know for The Wire?
but I mean, like, true.
They're very different counties. Prince George's County is a predominantly Black, African-American county. And I guess for a long time, maybe even currently, it's one of the most affluent, populous, predominantly Black counties in the country. So I'm very proud of my county. Went to college there in the University of Maryland and moved from there to New York and then New York to here. But then when I was little, when I was like 9, my parents tricked me into living in Ghana for a year and a half. So I was, you know that threat that foreign
Get
parents
into that
gave
trick.
You?
You're glossing over this, but I want to know about the trick.
So they said I was going on vacation. Basically what happened was kindergarten through third grade, I was in a small Catholic school in Montgomery County. So not my county. So it was a distance away. And my older sister was 9 years old or is 9 years older than me. So she went to the high school down the street. So when she graduated in 12th grade, there was no one to bring me home after school anymore. So I had to go to the like local public school and become a latchkey kid, take this, bus home. And it was my first time in public school. So I'm like getting acclimated. I'm used to like structure and rigor and like sitting up like a little church boy in my desk and being quiet. But like I get to the public school and people are throwing paper and talking, the teacher's trying to talk over people. So I'm trying to, make friends and figure out what's going on. And the teacher wrote me a note home saying I was being disruptive. So I gave the note to my mom. It was like, hey, the teacher said, give this to you. And she took it and I guess freaked out quietly because she very calmly, like the next week was like, Eric, we're going to go on vacation to Ghana. Wow. Even though it's the middle of fourth grade. So
it took her a week. It took her a week to be like, time to get this boy out of here.
Yep. We got to vacate him immediately. We got to get him out of there. So my mom, me, my little brother, who was 4 at the time, flew to Ghana in the middle of the school year. And then we hung out for like 2 weeks at my uncle's place, who I didn't know. And then my mom packed her bags and was like, all right, bye guys. And flew back to Maryland and left me and my brother there with my uncle to go to school.
Wait, she left?
She'd left. Yeah. She went back to Maryland. So then we started going to school and I was like, you don't go to school on vacation. What's going on here? I'm getting fitted for a school uniform. This is different.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That is a trick. That is a trick.
She left you. I don't know why that's so funny. Because I had a similar experience, but my family left me in Baltimore. I'm not joking.
What?
Wait, what?
There was a few summers where, the first summer they did it, I learned what was happening a few summers later. We had some family friends who had moved to Baltimore and they would take us there. And then the first summer they left me. They're like, you're going to be here for a few weeks. Bye. And then I just had to like hang out with that family for a few weeks. And then that
Like, what was the motive?
I don't know what their motive was, but like, it was more like they just were like, you're annoying. I was a teen. I was angsty. I was like, fuck yeah. I was smoking weed, like getting into drinking. And they were like, no, you have to go to Baltimore. And then I like went to Baltimore and I was like, okay, like now I'm in Baltimore. Like,
yeah, where it's stuff like that is very accessible. Lots of drugs, lots of alcohol.
But I guess they thought like the family friends would take care of me because they had like younger kids. So I just was like hanging out with like kids the whole time and being like, this is shady.
Well, where did you grow up though?
I grew up in the Bay Area, California. Okay. So it was just kind of like, I mean, it was fine. This was also before The Wire really was like a prominent thing. So like, I didn't even know what was up in Baltimore. I was just like in Baltimore and that's
it. But you're telling me that not only did your parents got a break from you, but you were also the family's babysitter. So both adults benefited from this
arrangement. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty strange. It's one of those weird things I don't really, I don't think about it very often of like, oh God, remember mom and dad would just leave me in Baltimore for the summer. But the family actually did a few years later move to Reisterstown, I believe it's called.
In Maryland, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I stayed in Reisterstown for like a summer. And then after that, I never went back because I think I went to college eventually.
You aged out of being shipped places.
Yeah. Yeah, well, they stopped, like, going and then leaving. They would just put me on a plane.
Ah.
Which was cool, because when you travel alone, when you're young on a plane, you have a very high chance of being bumped to first class. So, I'm not gonna lie.
Nice.
I had a first class trip at one point.
Hot towel and champagne.
Yeah. Like, 16, like, and this is life.
I ain't never go back.
Mm-mm. Eric, what was that like for you as a child growing up in the U.S. and then suddenly growing up in Ghana?
Yeah.
Had you been previously to that time?
I had with my family. Like, we went on, like, vacations and stayed together the whole time. But then going by myself. So I started doing therapy last year, like, in the midst of the quarantine over Zoom.
Good and, timing.
Yeah, right? And I told my therapist that story. And I guess the word she and I came to agreement about it is traumatizing. It was trauma. Because,
of course.
I didn't know what was going on. They lied to me. I'm with new people. I didn't know what was going on. So that's weird. And I may or may not have mommy issues now. So that's something I got to deal with. However, some silver linings of it, I got to go be where my family's from. You know, my family's from Ghana. I saw where my mom grew up, like the village where my grandma's lived. And, you know, it was, you know, 99, 2000. And there's always been a Black president in Ghana. So I got to see that firsthand. I got to see billboards with Black folks on them and like a country run by Black people. And you know, there was peace and it was nice and fun. And, you know, I was like, oh, we really can do whatever we want. It was like Wakanda before Wakanda. Mm-hmm. And so like I had the kind of you really can do anything you want, even though you're Black. And actually, because you're Black, in my head, long before a lot of my, you know, Black American peers. So that kind of like accidentally happened. I don't know if that was part of the plan, but it was definitely a benefit of living in Ghana when I was little.
That is pretty cool.
Yeah, that's a good silver lining to glean from that experience, because I'm sure when Barack Obama was elected, you were like, yeah, about time.
Yeah.
Like, we all were like that, but you were actually like, come on.
Come on, States, y'all are late.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we all thought about time, for the record.
Yeah. Not all of us.
Good point.
Did you ever really kind of address with your family that trauma you experienced by them just leaving you?
Not real. Like, I talked to my brother about it, of course, and my sister. She got set the year after.
By herself?
No. So to kind of join us, but like she got sent to live with a different like family member. So like we all kind of got kicked out and lived in Ghana, 98, 99, 2000. And I've tried to talk to my mom about it a little bit. I've been like, why did y'all trick me or trick us into living in Ghana? And I don't really ever get an answer from her. It's just something she don't want to talk about. So I just kind of leave it be.
I like that. Why did you trick us?
Right. It's like, why are we bringing up old shit, Eric?
Yeah. I mean, you know what? Maybe both your parents were operatives, agents, and they just needed y'all gone.
Yes.
You know?
Like, they had some high-profile assassinations coming up. They didn't want collateral damage or anyone to be able to be taken out easily.
They were protecting you. I'm kidding. But they definitely gave you abandonment issues. But
I will say, fair. When my brother was really acting out in school, like, my parents were going to leave him in Iran to like be raised by like really strict Iranian family members. And like, that's like a threat you always get. Like I had one family friend who was just like a really shitty kid. And sorry, my cat.
Is he
my
back
cat.
There?
Yeah, my cats are fucking shit up. But I had one family friend who they took him to Iran for a summer and he came back and you can tell like everything about him was like, I got whipped into shape. Like he was the nicest, quietest, like before he would just be like, fuck, to like piss off the parents. He was also like, whatever, 10, 11, just to be annoying. And I'd always think he was so funny because I was like, this fool crazy. But
so he was a child.
Yeah, he was a child, but describing. He came back and he was like the most well-behaved kid. And it is kind of like a vibe of like the immigrant parents or like whatever parents from other places will just be like, I'll send you to the homeland. I will show you how to get your shit together. So maybe your mom seeing that note was like, uh-oh.
Yeah, let me cut this off at the head before it gets worse. Yeah. And like the threat is real. Like I never got the threat. I had cousins and, you know, my older sister was kind of wilding out a little bit. Understandably so. She's a teenager. Like teenagers wild out. You don't fucking exile them, or at least I wouldn't. But like, I had, you know, I had cousins that threw chairs at teachers in class and like fought other kids, and they always got the threat, but I never got the threat, and I got one note home, and I'm the one that got sent. So you it just goes to show you that there's no justice in the world.
Mm-hmm. No. Absolutely not.
I like the use of the word exiled. It's so
and this is it's really funny in this context.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, wasn't expecting that, to be honest. But I'm really glad that you shared that with us.
Absolutely.
But so we were there for a year?
A year and a half. Yeah, it was the did second you half know, of fourth grade and then all of fifth grade.
Did you know after you realized you were staying that it wasn't permanent? Or was the year like a surprise? Like, oh, you're going back now.
It was a surprise when they were like, all right, y'all are coming back now. Because I figured I was just going to be there till at least the end of high school. Like, I kind of made peace with it and was like, yeah, this place is great. It don't snow. Everybody looks like me.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
Yeah. Well, no. So how was that experience, I guess, on both the tail ends of it, but in the middle, it's such a different experience than growing up in America. It's like, everyone looks like you. There's no... the dynamic here is awful, to say the least. But what was that for you, especially as a child?
Yeah. At the beginning, when I was like scared and confused and bewildered, I at least had my little brother. And like, especially talking about it in therapy, I remember my brother was super like, what's happening? So he was like crying a lot when we first got there.
Oh.
So I remember having to put on a strong face for him and being like, it's okay, I'm here. Like, we'll figure it out. These people don't seem that weird so far. Like, so I remember not crying myself when I probably really needed to, but I felt like
the older sibling, putting up that front for the younger sibling. Yeah.
Yeah. And so then in the middle, I kind of got used to being there. Like, I developed like the accent of my family members and kids at school and, you know, got into like the routine. You go to school, you come home, you do your homework, you iron your uniform, you know, wash your clothes by hand in a big metal tub, like, you know, that whole, I guess, lifestyle. And then it didn't become like, oh man, I'm not in America anymore. It was like, all right, I'm in Ghana. It's hot again. Like, what are we doing today? What are we doing this weekend?
Well, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, see, you know, I
know you were abandoned there, but regardless, I like the idea of like coming home, ironing your uniform. I really like structure like that.
I mean, you say that now as an adult, but like, I'm sure as a kid, you would have like, I don't know.
Oh, if I had structure as a kid, I would not have been sent to fucking Baltimore every summer to keep me away from my like shady friends.
Yeah.
But wow, what an experience. No structure.
Do you keep in touch with those shady friends at all?
Oh, yeah. They're all, like, my closest friends.
Oh, nice. Can't keep a good friendship broken up.
Whatever, you know? So they're all just, like, the people I grew up with, so they're all just still the homies, you know?
Yeah.
Nice try, parents, but what are you going
to
do?
Like, I remember when I got back to Maryland. So I came back the summer before sixth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And so then my parents put me in the same public school that I was in that they like yanked me out of. And so there were kids, a few kids from fourth grade, who when I got back for sixth grade, they're like, you look familiar. Weren't you here a few years ago? And then like, I have my Ghanaian accent. So I was like, yes, that was me. I was sent to Ghana, but now I'm back.
That is so funny. It took you like a year just to pick, like, how naturally did that come to you?
Oh, okay, real quick. I mean, because wow. I was like inundated. Like everyone yeah. around me spoke that way. So to yeah. not sound weird. And then it was jarring for everyone there because, you know, I'm dark skinned. I look Ghanaian. And yeah. then like I open my mouth and I talk like this and they're like, oh, a Yankee. Like yeah. it kind of fucked them up. So
you had to adapt and then you adapted and you were sent back.
Right.
And then you had to adapt again.
Exactly.
Basically. Yeah. Wow, that is wild. Okay, I want to ask you so many more things. But first, mm-hmm. let's take our first commercial break. We'll be right back. And we are back with Eric Owusu. I like saying your name with some oomph, as you said earlier.
I like your name.
it's a good name to say with oomph. It's fun.
Thank you.
Okay, so Glass, we left off with you coming back to Maryland, having an accent. Did you consciously again adapt and you were like, oh, I have to get rid of this now?
Probably, but then again, like, you know, you get thrown into the pond of, you know, the Maryland American accent, and then you adapt again. Mm-hmm. But I guess I had a baseline because that's what I grew up with. So I guess the accent went away pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. Like within a couple months, I was talking like this again.
Yeah, it's wild. I really believe we're so capable of as children to pick up accents in languages even. And mm-hmm. it's always surprising to me just how capable we are of going somewhere. Like, literally, I was in Russia for 2 weeks and I felt like I was like so much more fluent in it than when I was there 2 weeks ago. So imagine living there. Imagine living anywhere. You have to adapt. You have no choice. So yeah, it always blows my mind whenever I think about it. And I'm sure if I went to Syria and lived there for an extended amount of time, if I was a kid that I remember, because I was there when I was in, like a toddler, mm-hmm. I would have picked it up too. And I actually did. I had an accent when I came back to the States. That's what I'm saying it out loud. I had an accent and people made fun of my sister and I because we talked like our mom who taught us English and she has an accent. So we said things in her accent. But anyway, so you're in Maryland and you're adapting. When you're a kid and young adult going into high school, did you like comedy? Like, what made you attracted to comedy?
Well, my family, we're all big laughers. We like to hang out, have fun, make fun of each other, make fun of stuff and laugh together. So we always loved watching comedies. So like growing up, I loved The Simpsons and Martin and the Wayans brothers. And just, you know, we didn't have cable when I was growing up. So I watched everything on broadcast TV. And then as I became a teenager, my sister, again, 9 years older, she had like DVDs and stuff she would watch. So I remember she had Martin Lawrence's You So Crazy. So that was one of the first stand-up specials I watched and like loved. And then when I got to high school, I met a kid named Jameson who was a super like stand-up comedy fan. So he like listened to old albums and records and stuff. And he was like, yo, you're funny. Like, have you seen Eddie Murphy's Raw and Delirious? And I'm like, Dr. Doolittle? He did stand-up? I'm like, nah, like, you got to go look these up. I was talking about this the other day. So I went home. This is like 05, 06, because I graduated high school in like 07. And I went on the torrents and I illegally mm-hmm. downloaded Eddie Murphy's Raw and Delirious and like a bunch of Chappelle specials from back then, or his two from back then. And like, gobbled them up and like memorized them. I could say them backwards and forwards, and like that got me into really like loving and enjoying watching stand up. But back then, I didn't have like the inclination of like, oh, I'm going to be a comedian. Like I was like, I'm kind of funny. I definitely have family members that are funnier than me. Like that get us all crying laughing. So I was like trying to keep up with them whenever we would be around each other.
That's big of you to admit.
Yeah. I would never admit that. If you want some advice.
I'm the funniest one in my entire family. I will die on this hill.
Not a single person in my family is allowed to make a joke when I'm around.
Because they're all trash at it. You're the master.
If I hear a single chuckle that doesn't come towards me, I'm so pissed.
If I hear one setup to a knock knock joke that I'm not doing, all hell will break loose.
A part of me just realized a way to get, I mean, like, it's kind of shady for our parents to like ditch us somewhere because it's like, I'll see you in your 70s, motherfucker.
Yo, for real, yo, that's a really good, that's a really good point. I'll be like, hey, Ma, you're up in age now. Remember how you left me somewhere for someone else to take care of me? Well, guess how far the tables have turned.
Yeah, just how petty are you? Well, I'll tell you how. Hey. You'll find out.
It's a petty party.
60 years. For this moment.
I know. He was just waiting.
Yeah.
What's that, doctor? She has signs of dementia? All right. Guess who's going to Ghana?
All right. Y'all got your hands full. I'm sorry.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Every present I buy my mom after she turns like 65 will have a brochure to a new retirement home in it.
She's like, watch your back.
That's really funny.
I probably won't do that because...
Oh no!
You better. Well, so this is a thing. You guys have probably started hearing and feeling this already. Like the reason people have the joking reason that people have daughters is so that they'll have someone to take care of them when they get older.
Oh, it's not a joke. It's true. and as far as I know, Middle Eastern families. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's 100% true.
Yeah, no, it's the same over here. So it's like I'm kind of getting away scot free. I won't leave my sister completely to take care of my parents herself, but maybe. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, my mom definitely took on that role as the oldest daughter in the family, even though she's not the oldest child. Mm-hmm. But she's the oldest daughter, and she's been there for them a lot. Right now, they live in West Virginia.
Okay.
That's what that state's called. So it's really hard for my mom because she was so used to being the one like to take care of them. But they got an opportunity to like have a house and like afford to live much better than they did in California. So, but it's really hard, especially with the pandemic. You know, it's just, when are you going to see them again? There's no assurance. So, I don't know. I feel for my mom and all my family. But before I get too sappy, let's go back. You're in high school. You like comedy. You don't see it as a viable career option. So, what do you see as for yourself if you were imagining back then?
I didn't know because I was the artsy kid. I always was drawing and making comic books and stuff like that. So I was like, oh, art's not a real viable job either. But architecture is a thing I hear people say with respect. And they put some respect on architecture's name. So maybe that. So then when I got to college, I still didn't know what I wanted to do when I got in. I just was like taking the electives, taking the core classes and just figuring shit out. And then sophomore year, I got a flyer to audition for the campus sketch comedy group. So yeah, I went to the audition. I didn't know what to expect because I never really performed. So jumping back in time, I almost got into theater and became a theater kid in fourth grade because I joined the like Shakespeare Club just as like, oh, I remember they did Romeo and Juliet as an episode of Wishbone. This looks familiar. Like, let's...
Oh my God.
I loved
Wishbone. Oh my God. Thank you for reminding me of Wishbone. What a dog.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love those shows. Yeah. But yeah, I remember that. So I went to the Shakespeare Club and we were going to do A Midsummer Night's Dream. And I was like real excited. I was meeting the other theater kids. We were starting to read the play together in the after school club. And then I got yanked out of school and sent to Ghana. So that kind of kept me from being a theater kid or starting the journey to become a theater kid. So I never really performed before, but I was never shy. Like I would like read Bible verses in church whenever they were like, we need somebody to read this or whatever. So I went to the audition for the sketch comedy group. The group's called SketchUp. It's still going. And I had a note card of one-liners that I wrote of like topical material. They were god-awful because I didn't know what I was doing. So I show up at the audition like, hey, I'm here to audition. Like, I have these jokes. I got these one-liners. And they're like, you can throw that in the trash. It's going to be improv games. Like, you're fine. And then, yeah, I auditioned. I had a good time. I didn't feel any pressure to, like, I was just like, oh, this is fun. Like, let me just have fun. And then I made it to the callbacks and made it in. And that legit, like, sent me on my comedy journey.
That's beautiful. I mean, now that you say it that way, that's a whole another level of trauma because it's almost like you took something from me, you know? Like I could have performed my whole childhood, you know? Mm. So, oh, you didn't thought, oh, did I just introduce New Drama to you? Oh,
you
no.
might have. I wasn't even thinking about it that
way. Oh, fuck it's just me. Like, oh, I'm so sorry.
No. Damn.
And just piling it on. I got more shit to talk to my therapist about. Thank okay. you so much, Shireen.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
You That's good because my therapist's pocket.
You could have been like Michael B. Jordan.
Oh, my God.
I could add more.
You could have been like John David Washington. Oh, no. Daniel yeah. Kaluuya. Oh, no.
Damn.
No.
Well,
no. Those are all people that started young. Yes, because my,
I mean,
oh,
no, but
John David,
Washington,
no, he was a football player.
Yeah. But Washington is not the same. Washington yeah, has his dad. So
he's
so
got his genes. Yeah.
yeah. But like Kaluuya, well, like he was a child, not a child, but he was a teen. Basically, he was in Skins back in
yeah,
the day. And fucking Michael B. That's Wallace, mm-hmm. baby.
Yeah, back
that's
in
Wallace
the wire.
From the wire.
Yeah. It all comes back to Baltimore.
Yeah. yeah. yeah, it all goes back. So that, yeah, you. That's interesting because they did cast a lot of people out of Baltimore in that area to be on mm-hmm. the wire. So yeah.
don't make it worse, Anna. Don't make it worse.
I could have been. You. I could have been right there with Wallace.
Yeah. yeah. Oh God, where's Wallace well. String? Where's Wallace? I don't know why that scene will never leave me. I think about it all the time.
Damn.
Idris That's a good Elba, one. Man. Idris,
I mean,
Elba
Idris
and
Elba.
Michael B.
I know.
What?
Yeah.
What a show. Truly, show what is... a show. I remember when I first watched it.
Damn.
I feel like it was one of the first things I saw Idris Elba in.
Me
and
too.
And I was blown away when I realized he was English.
Yes.
I was like,
yes.
what?
I think we all were. We were all like, Stringer?
Yeah.
Stringer
he was by far
British.
My favorite character. He was by far my favorite character. And... I'm just obsessed with him ever since.
I think
obsessed.
He was a lot of women's favorite character because we're like, well, I guess he's a bad guy, but oh
my God. But he looks so good while doing it.
he's dirty and he has glasses.
yeah. Yeah. He can't be sketches. That bad. He needs a prescription to see.
Yeah, yeah exactly. Yeah.
He sketches in the courtroom.
Right. right.
He's an artist.
Some of us shout too much. Some of us murder. Like, it's all good. who am I to judge?
Yeah, exactly.
It is sad, but like... My like 15-year-old mind was low key like, well, hello.
Oh, that's not sad. That is factual. That is, yeah, that was all of us.
You're right. I won't apologize for my horny teen years watching The Wire too young to understand really what was going on. But hey, look, mm-hmm. I found the box set at Costco and it looked cool. And I was like, can I buy this? Mom was like, sure, whatever. And then that's like yeah. how I was introduced to The Wire. I just thought the first season's box set was cool. And then I was like, this is on HBO? And then I just started watching it live after that. And I remember my dad always being like, what? How did you find this show? And I'd be like, it's about Baltimore. There's a real serious drug problem there. I think you need to sit down and learn a little bit about what's going on over there.
Now, was this before or after you were being sent to Baltimore?
This was a little before Baltimore. So this was like kind of in the middle. And then I learned a lot about Baltimore because I started watching The Wire. I started learning all about wiretaps. I started learning so much about like how the police work. Learned all about the like racism for Polish people in season 2. About
and
the docks.
Yep.
yeah. I learned so much from The Wire. Like most of my education is from The Wire.
I wasn't allowed to watch any HBO, so all of my HBO watching, I had to catch up as an adult. Sopranos, The Wire, everything, anything on HBO, I was not allowed to watch. I was very sheltered growing up. Even literally Seinfeld, I didn't watch until I was an adult.
Wow.
But yeah, watching as an adult was a trip because I understood all these inside jokes that everyone would talk about and all these things. So my horniness for Idris Elba wasn't that creepy because I was an adult, if that makes it any better.
Yeah, that's a little less creepy thinking about a teenager's horniness.
yeah,
about
thank you.
I also was like really into McNulty. I don't
know.
I was just like horned up by these like cops and robbers, basically.
McNulty irritated the shit out of me.
Look, he wasn't the greatest cop, you know, and that's I think what we're looking at is flaws.
Fair.
I'm out of my mind.
Fair. Let's bring
move
you back
far away from this.
yeah, that was a great tangent. I'm not gonna lie, I loved every second of it.
But real quick, my dirty little secret is I've never seen all of The Wire. I just know a lot about it. So
Eric's fine.
I know. I might take it up. I might just jump in and just watch it. Because my sister loved it. She made me the season one box set and was like, you gotta watch this. And I watched the first three and I was like, I want to slit my wrists. I don't want to watch this no more.
Yeah. It's a heavy show.
Yeah.
What I was like, really, when I was young, I really liked gritty shit. I don't know why. I just was like really into like, just like edgy. And I think it's because like my life was so like pancake. You know, it's like pancake.
But I also can see how, as a Black man, watching that show is definitely probably different than both of us watching it, you know? So I don't, no pressure on watching it now that I'm thinking about it, you know, in your own time or never. I completely understand.
Thank we you, Shereen, allow it. You not to watch it. Do you understand?
Okay. You don't think, thank you so much, Anna. You have no idea how much that means to me.
We're just like white girl monsters. We give you the permission to not watch. Thank
we are
you.
Actual allies, and we are telling you.
I appreciate you guys being so benevolent on this Women's Day. Being so benevolent.
Bringing it back to us. Bringing it back to women.
Feel free to thank us.
We just wait for you to thank us like 30 minutes.
We don't go on.
All right. Thank you, Shereen. Thank you, Anna.
No, I was kidding. Please don't thank me.
Thank you. I was not kidding. I was not kidding.
I covered my bases.
Yeah. Okay. I want to go back to you in college. Do you tell your parents that you are interested in comedy when you start doing this improv thing? What was your experience in college doing that?
So I got into the group sophomore year. And at the beginning of sophomore year, I still was like, I don't know what I want to do. I don't know what I want to major in. And my mom was like, you should be a doctor. I can see you being a doctor.
Yes.
You know, yeah. Yep. And I was like, I like helping people. That sounds noble. And that's not enough to pass calculus, chem one, and bio in the same semester forever in the rest of your college career. So like, I bombed those classes super hard. And my counselor, when she was helping me pick those classes, she was like, you're probably going to want a chill class. Like, what else are you interested in? I was like, oh, I've been drawing forever. Are there any art classes? And she got me into like an art class. So I got an A in that. And then I kind of stumbled on the sketch comedy group. So I auditioned for that, got in. So that was going to be like my like, you know, fun side thing, elective recess type thing. So bombed all the science classes or whatever. And after that, I was like, yo, I got to get out of this. Like, I'm not going to graduate. Like, I'm going to hate my life. So I switched to art as a major and decided to stick with being in the comedy group. And I didn't tell my parents initially. I think I told my dad first because my dad, in my experience, is more level-headed and whatever, whatever. So I tell him, I was like, hey, I tried the pre-med thing. It's not for me. I'm going to do this art thing. I love comedy. This is what I'm going to do because this is what I love. And he's like, he listened to me and he was like, you know, I hear you, but you're probably not going to make any money for a long time. And I was like, cool. Like, that's the path I'm choosing for myself with my name on all these goddamn loans. And then I think the next year, I told my mom that I switched. And she was not as understanding. And it took her a long time to not be angry about it. She's still not fully, like, supportive, but she's at least not actively against it, spit and vitriol. So
yeah.
You're wearing her down year by year, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. By the time I put her in the home, then she'll have really come around.
Yeah.
She better.
No.
Right. Or else she's getting a significantly less quality home that comedy's paying for.
But that's a reason for her to be like, I told you so. Look how shitty this place is.
Right.
Exactly.
Like, but yeah, she'll mom, that's why you're in the shitty one.
Yeah. Yeah, she'll always win in the end. But, I mean, totally relatable. I feel like both Anna and I were told we should be lawyers because we like to argue. Mm. And I was like, yeah, you're good point. And I also, when I was in high school, before I realized art or anything was possible for someone like me, I was convinced, I was like, well, I'm really depressed. Maybe I should be a psychiatrist. And then I failed AP chemistry. And in the inverse, I was passing all of my photography classes, and I was loving the art classes. And it's kind of sad how we deny ourselves of our actual passions only because we are not convinced it's possible for us, you know?
Yeah. And or other people tell us that there's no future in it.
Exactly. We either don't see people like us or we don't get the support from our families. It's like a mixture of everything, really. And my parents finally came around when I was like early to mid-20s, really. And when I came to LA and met so many people that always had supportive parents, like there was part of me that was a little bit like about it. But yeah, now I understand everyone has their own paths, you know.
Yeah. I don't know how I would have fared going after comedy without a little bit of doubt in my sails, if that makes sense. Like if I had two parents who were like, you can do anything, you're amazing and precious, our angel, I might have just been more lackadaisical about it, like knowing me. So I kind of needed someone to a little bit prove wrong. I love comedy, and you know, this, if I'm going to struggle doing anything, I would love it to be comedy, and it has been a little bit of a struggle at times, but you know, I kind of am like, you know, take that, Ma, like, look whose name is on TV, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah, you shouldn't struggle for something that doesn't give you at least a little bit of, like, fire or whatever, a less cliche way to say that.
Yeah.
Should we take our second break? How do you feel about that?
Really? Okay. No.
Honestly,
it looks like we're not done it.
Not yet. We'll be right back with Eric. BRB. We're back.
Yeah.
What a mood shift.
I've been here the whole time.
The whole time?
Yeah, it's been 2 seconds.
Yes, it's true.
Okay.
That's that. Bye.
You're right.
Wait. So what degree did you end up graduating with?
I graduated with a Bachelor of Fine Arts in Studio Art. So that's being a professional artist who makes work and pieces for museums and gallery showings and exhibitions and stuff like that. So being a legit artist, that's what my degree is in. So the last year of college, I took a year of painting. So I painted a whole bunch of stuff. I learned how to make my own canvases. And I painted a really dark series of paintings focused on nooses to try to explore something that terrified me. I should have gotten like a certificate in African-American lit studies, but I was an English minor. So the only books that I love reading cover to cover are like African-American stories, fiction, nonfiction, autobiography of Malcolm X, like the fiction works of, or nonfiction works of Anthony Grooms and Octavia Butler. And I just read my first Toni Morrison book. So that's my shit. So I remember doing a screen print of an image that I came up with. I drew, it was of a black dude with like, you know, no shirt on, with lash marks on his back, with a machete raised up above his head on his way towards a tree that had a noose hanging from it. So that was the image I like screen printed. Wow. And so I took that to my painting professor, who was super cool, super chill. His name's Pat Craig. He's awesome. And I was like, I want to paint this. And he's like, all right, well, before you paint this whole thing, you've already done this image. So what is it about this image that you find the most powerful or jarring or whatever? I'm like, the noose. He's like, paint the noose. So I proceeded to paint the noose one time, and then I painted it another time, but in a different style. And so I painted it in a bunch of different styles and iterations and stuff. I did like a pop art, bright pink, yellow Andy Warhol version of it. Wow. I did a really dark, like black and white one. I did like almost photorealistic one that's a real innocuous one. It's like the viewpoint is of you're standing in a suburban kitchen with like the cabinets and the sink and the counter and everything, and then through the window looking into the backyard you see real small in the distance the noose hanging from the tree.
So I mean, even you describing it, it feels so powerful, you know. It's such an amazing undertaking. All of them, you know.
Thanks.
Yeah,
I left them at my mom's place in Maryland, so I hope they still all exist. That she didn't get rid of them.
She'll get rid of them when you put her in that home. She's going to burn them, you know?
Right.
Like, that's what you get.
For heat, because I'm not going to put her in a home with heat. So that's what'll happen.
Wow.
Damn, dog. That's intense. No heat. Damn, dude. I was just joking earlier. You don't need to torture your mom like this. No heat. In Maryland, of all places. Like,
she'll be all right. She's tough.
She's cold.
Tough,
actually, in Ghana, that's fine. No heat.
That would be fine.
But in Maryland. That's rough, especially with like climate change. We don't even know where this shit's headed.
Oh yeah, we don't know what things will feel like in like 20 years, 20, 30 years. Oh, yeah. Fingers crossed for you, Mom.
I'll keep you in my prayers. So, yeah. Okay, you graduate. You're really making, honestly, poignant fucking pieces of art, man. You should do that again.
I still make, like, artwork. So I also did a lot of graphic design. Like, right. I got Photoshop and learned how to use Photoshop and Illustrator in college. So I because I was the artsy kid, they kind of put me in the role of advertising director of my sketch comedy group. So basically, I designed and made the flyers. But then I made flyers for other people, so that got me into graphic design and kind of marketing and advertising. And then I've made flyers for the late night show that Fizza hosted before. Mm-hmm. And I made flyers for my own comedy shows like throughout the year. So it all ties in. And I only really paint when it's someone's birthday and I don't know what to buy them. So I just make a really personalized painting for people.
My birthday's coming up.
Mine too.
Hey, here we go. What do you guys like?
Commissioning art from you right now.
That was the whole intention. Like, we already knew you made art and everything. It was like, let's just get him on the show.
Let's talk him up about his poignant art and then get some free paintings out of him. Hey, is it not a bad plan?
So how did you transition into comedy from that?
So doing the sketch comedy group was awesome. And I love everybody I performed with, 100%. But I realized, because the group was mostly white kids, Jewish kids. And when I got in, I was one of three black kids. And then our third guy kind of left. And then it was just two of us for my second year there. And then my third year there, I was the only black person. And I very quickly learned that if I didn't write for myself, like, I'd be relegated to black best friend in a sketch or kid with a funny accent in a sketch and nothing like for me to kind of shine. So I ended up writing sketches for myself a lot more often. I wrote group stuff, but also stuff for me. And then I started doing stand-up. And I was like, oh, I'm a one-man show. Like, I can really do and say whatever I want, however often I want. Because with sketch, we had to wait till the end of the semester to do our group show. Stand-up, I could go do it every night, two nights a week, whenever. But yeah, so then I started doing stand-up in Maryland around campus and on campus and in D.C. and fell in love with that. And that was just like another avenue of comedy that I was like, yo, I really fuck with this and I'm getting better at it as I do it. My first time, I bombed spectacularly in rare form, that bomb. But it was good because I got the bomb out of the way early. Mm-hmm. I think a comic's or a comedian's worst fear is bombing, getting no laughs, like just failing miserably. So because I got that out of the way early and I didn't die from the experience, I was like, oh, there's nowhere to go but up. So that really helped me be more fearless on stage.
There's nowhere to go but up. That's a good way to look at it.
Yeah.
Instead of being like, well, that was a wash. Bye.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's how I felt immediately after the bomb. But... Mm-hmm. You know, being you know, foreign kid number two in sketches after that was like, oh, I need to figure out the stand-up thing. Otherwise, I'll never get to be funny on stage, really.
Yeah. Hi, I'm foreign kid number two. I'll be reading for foreign kid number two.
Okay, what brought you to L.A.?
So after college, I applied to go to grad school in New York and L.A., but didn't get into either. So I ended up staying at home still and working on Maryland's campus and doing a bunch of comedy in D.C. I was doing way more stand-up. I started filming roundtable discussions with, like, comics who had been doing it for a while and, like, other new comics like me.
That's a great idea.
Thank you. Yeah, my homegirl, Mabinsi Yilla, she's dope. She's a friend from Maryland, the University of Maryland. She's been on her, like, I'm trying to be the next Diddy, like, since I met her when we were, like, 19, 20. So she was like, yo, you're funny. Like, here's some things I've seen work for other people that I think you can do right here, right now in 2011, 2012. So it's her idea. She was like, yo, do these roundtable discussions and put them on YouTube. Tape your sets, put them on YouTube. Like, do some sketches, put them on YouTube. So I did a bunch of that.
That's a good friend right there.
She's a great friend, yeah. I gotta send her flowers when I get a chance. So it's just like, hey, homie, I was talking about you in a podcast. Mm-hmm. Appreciate you.
Make her a painting.
I should make her a painting. Yeah. And then the next year, I applied to grad school programs for TV writing producing, and I got into one in New York. So I moved to New York. The school was in Brooklyn, and I did that and, you know, was living in New York. That was kind of the excuse to move to New York and continue comedy. Because I knew my parents weren't just going to let me, like, go to New York just to be like, I want to be a comedy person. Yay! Yeah. So I was up there, did the grad program, made my connections. And then so, long story short, an alumni of the University of Maryland who was also in the sketch comedy group like 7 years before me heard about me because my professor in New York was cool with a professor at Maryland who was cool with the alumni guy. And was like, hey, this kid Eric is from Maryland and he's funny and he's great. Like, you know, talk to this guy. The mentor's name is Mike. So Mike was like, yo, I'm in LA. I just got my first staff writing gig. But years ago, I did the CBS Diversity Showcase as a writer. Like, I think it would be a good thing for you to try to do. Like, you know, send me your packet and I'll see if I can help you get in. And I'd send a packet. He liked it. I flew out to LA to like meet with him and a lady that worked at CBS who kind of ran the program, and they liked me enough to bring me on as a writer. And yeah, I decided to leave New York. I had just gotten my, well, not just, but I was in my first like full-time gig in New York. I had benefits, but I was like, let me drop all this and move to LA and work for free in a basement for 4 or 5 months. And hopefully it'll help me reach my goals. And, and I did it. And fortunately, it worked out. I did the CBS showcase. I met FZA, worked with FZA, and met a bunch of dope people who I still work with to this day. I met my, you know, writing partner. I dropped off cupcakes at her place yesterday because her birthday's on Wednesday. Like, that's the homie. And then me and her eventually, like, got staffed on a Disney Channel show. So I'm in the Writers Guild. I accomplished the dream, and I'm still, like, writing and pitching and, you know, doing the things.
Hell yeah. I'm so glad that risk paid off for you, because that's a risk, you know, leaving for a job with benefits and everything. Like, your parents would have been like, you're making a mistake. I just know it.
But they kind of, I feel like they bit their tongue a lot for that one, because they didn't really give me shit about that until like I was in LA and shit got real and I was like, hey, can you help me with rent? And they're like, why'd you leave your job? Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, they're holding it in the whole time, just waiting for you to, like, reach out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But now that's amazing. You got jobs, so.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I haven't working for Disney. A long time,
so. Disney's good.
Mm-hmm.
Is Disney good? Yeah. No. I don't know anything.
Yeah, it's good considering, like, it's a job that you get paid to write for.
That's the household name. So, like, I feel like my parents, if I was like, I got a job with Disney, they'd be like, oh, thank God, that's something I've heard of. Versus like, I'm like, I got a job at this obscure network. Trust me, it's a startup. You know, like, that. I feel like that's so much more.
Yeah,
like, with Disney, they know you get, like, benefits. With, like, a startup, they're like, you're an intern.
Yeah. So funny about that, my parents were both of those reactions personified. Because when I got the gig, at the time I was working at a talent agency in Santa Monica as a front desk guy. And like, I'd been going on meetings and like with my writing partner, and we kept having good meetings, but then no one would pick us up. We got like three staff writing meetings and then no one picked us up. And then we got the Ravens Home meeting and the showrunners were super lukewarm. We were like, oh, we bombed that meeting. Like, they don't give a fuck about us. And then that's the one we ended up getting. So the day I got the news, I was still at work, and like I was like, yo, I'm at my desk. I'm like, yo, I got the gig. Like, I told my coworkers and they're happy for me. And so I got off of work and I called my mom first, and she was super happy. She was like, oh, you got a job at Disney. Congrats. Like, I was like, thanks, mom. You know, I love you. Bye. And so I called my dad and I was like, hey, dad, I got a writing job at Disney. Like, I'm gonna be writing on a TV show. And my dad was like, oh, okay, is it going to be enough money to pay your bills and do your thing?
Straight to business.
Right. And I was like, yeah, Dad, I think it's going to be enough to pay some bills and then some.
Amazing. Amazing.
Wait, wow. Raven came back?
Yeah, it was a spinoff of That's So Raven.
What?
Yeah.
I just looked it up. I had no idea. I loved That's So Raven.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. I was a huge That's So Raven
fan. I didn't know she got a spinoff.
Yeah,
what the fuck? No one tells me anything.
I mean, there's so much TV on. Like, there's stuff I miss all the time.
I'm sure
it's
on Disney Plus at this point, right? I don't know.
Yeah. The first, like, 3 or 4 seasons are on Disney Plus, yeah. And my episode is on Disney Plus.
Oh, nice. Mm-hmm. Fuck yeah. But as far as first jobs go, Anna's right. Like, that's a name that could, you could meet so many people that could help you get another job. Like, that's the perfect best case scenario. So I'm just so glad it worked out.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
So Raven's back and she has a bunch of kids she lives with.
Yeah, it's a jamboree over there.
No, what is the story behind? I am actually curious. So how did she get here?
Yeah, so in the original Nessa Raven, she, you know, she's right. in San Francisco with her yeah. family and stuff. So yeah. in that Raven's Home, the spinoff, she's single with two kids. She's got twin kids, Booker and Nia.
Okay.
They're like, I think they're like 11 or 12 when the show starts. And she lives with Chelsea, her best friend from high school. Mm-hmm. And Chelsea's got a son. Chelsea's single also. So they're like two single moms living together in Chicago in an apartment.
Oh, they moved to Chicago.
Yeah. So Raven moved there with like fashion ambitions. Chelsea's figuring stuff out in the beginning of the show. And the son develops the psychic abilities to see into the future.
Wow.
So he has the visions. And at first they like keep the visions from... They keep the visions from each other. So the kids don't know Raven's psychic.
Oh,
Raven doesn't know the boy's psychic. Yeah.
Cool.
And hijinks ensue.
Mm-hmm. That's fine.
Well, that seems like a fun show to work on. I'm glad you got it.
Yeah, thanks. It was great.
So
you know.
We're coming on the end of this podcast, but before mm-hmm. we go all the way to the ending, you're working on Disney, all this other stuff. Bring us to the present day. Like, what are you, tell us what you're working on now, what you're, I mean, it's hard with the pandemic, obviously. I'm sure mm-hmm. so many things are on hold, and stand-up especially is suffering tremendously.
Yeah.
But have you gotten through it, and is there anything that's keeping you motivated?
Yeah. You know, the vaccine rollout and the good news about that is definitely keeping me motivated. But, you know, also, like, still the pursuit of writing and creating and collaborating. Like, at the beginning of the pandemic, my big, like, woe is me story is that I was supposed to go do a week of stand-up shows in Amsterdam.
Wow.
March 17th through the 23rd.
Wow.
Like right
just in
when
time.
Shit shut down. Yep. So I didn't get to do that. But, you know, I was able to, you know, stay in LA. Like a lot of people have had to move home or whatever. And I was able to finesse some things and stay here. And I wrote my first feature last year. And I'm working
Congrats.
On pilots. I was able to pitch a cartoon over Zoom, which was dope. I've done a couple Zoom comedy shows, like the one mm-hmm. you and I did. And I'm actively trying to pitch a cartoon right now to another network. And, you know, things are looking good with that. So I'm just kind of waiting on word. So, like, you know, the mission hasn't stopped. Like, I'm still creating. I'm putting myself out there. I'm cutting up old stand-up clips and putting those on my YouTube mm-hmm. or my Instagram, my Twitter, so people remember I'm funny.
Yeah. Remember? I could do this.
Right.
I could make you laugh.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, just remaining creative and I'm reading and I'm trying to balance productivity with relaxation since I don't have to be anywhere all the time. And, you know, the main goal of right now is survival. Mm-hmm. The only thing we have to try to do is survive. Everything else is icing on the cake. If you want to chill, cool. If you want to get in the best shape of your life, cool. But the only thing we should be focusing on is survival. So I've been trying to like keep that in mind. And not put too much pressure on myself and let myself just kind of live and be and, you know, all that good stuff.
I love that.
It's all you can do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like you have been very productive and I'm so proud of you. Just like the things you mentioned, those are huge things. The feature, the pilot, the pitching, the show. I mean, like it's, those are definitely big milestones that you should you should definitely be proud of yourself, you know?
Thank you. I'm
proud of you.
Oh, I appreciate that. I really do.
Yeah. I mean, I was so hard on myself in the beginning of the pandemic that because I wasn't as productive as I thought I should be.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still working on the same things, to be honest, that I was working on in the beginning. And I felt so shitty about that, being like, you have all the time in the world. Time mm-hmm. isn't an excuse anymore. But now you're depressed. And that's your excuse? Like, really? But no, I think you're totally right. Being kind to yourself and surviving is first and foremost the priority. And wording it that way is so necessary because if you can't survive, if you can't be kind to yourself, your work is going to suffer. I really do think that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I mean, even working on the late night show with you, that was one of the highlights of this whole time because it was, for me, it was the first time I was in a room. And it's being in a room has always been a dream of mine mm-hmm. because I just think it's really fun and collaborative. And I'm so grateful that I got like a taste of it, even if it was on the internet. But it was so fun and collaborative and reminded me that I'm funny. And
so,
I think those silver linings and those projects, even if they're different than they would be pre-COVID, there's still things to really enjoy and be proud of. And I'm proud of you. And I'm grateful to have met you.
Thank you. I'm proud of you too, Shireen. You really brought it. You were super funny, the things you pitched. And it's been dope meeting you and getting to talk to you. And you also, Anna, you guys are dope. And so with me, I don't know. I'm a Virgo. I put everything in my calendar. And I usually am the one who's super hard on myself. And so, I was talking to a homie recently. And he was he's 10 years older than me. And I was telling him about my frustrations, even though I'm pitching and doing things. I'm like, stuff's not happening. I need stuff to happen. And so he's like, oh, you got time. You're young. And he's known me 10 years. We met in New York for the grad program. So I'm like, you've been telling me I'm young for 10 years. You're not going to be able to say that forever. And also, I hate when people say, oh, you're young. You have time. Because we don't know how much time we have. I'm a perfectly healthy 30-some-year-old, but I could drop dead manana. I could, the trial of the cop that killed George Floyd is happening right now. That could be my fate that befalls me. So I don't know how much time I have. So I need stuff to happen right now is what I usually tell myself. So my realization during the pandemic of, survival is the only goal, chill, relax, and be productive if you want to be, was a big thing for me to realize and tell myself and fully believe. Because another homie has told me I have Tupac energy. I'm like, death is around the corner. you gotta put out an album every 2 weeks. That's been my vibe for a long time. So
that's a really good way to put it.
Life is beautiful. The meaning of life is to live it and enjoy it and experience it however you want to do it, but just live it. So that's what I'm learning myself and realizing and trying to put out in the world. And sharing this podcast and the late night show with you guys is a joyous part of life right now. And even though we're not IRL with each other, it's the internet. It's real. We're recording it. We're actually experiencing this and putting it out. So yeah, this is me rambling and saying that life is beautiful sometimes when we try to find the beauty. So I appreciate you guys.
I mean, perfect way to close out the show. That was beautiful.
Thank you.
Was it, Anna?
No, what if I don't agree? Hey, Eric, go fuck yourself. No, I'm just joking. I don't mean that at all. I actually really appreciate you saying all that. I think it's this industry fucking sucks, and it does feel like you have to constantly be putting out to stay relevant. And it's God, to not be relevant, what a fear, yet at the same time, what a dream to not have to worry about such things. And I experienced it a lot because my Twitter is my hellhole because it gets suspended or hacked, or I'm just harassed a lot on Twitter. And half the time I'm like, well, good, I'm done. I don't have to do this Twitter shit anymore. And this is just a metaphor for this industry to be like, well, fine, if you're going to reject me, fine. I don't need you. I'm going to move on. I'm going to have a happy life. And then a part of me is like, but then I won't be relevant anymore. And that's it's this constant push and pull, and your heart is in it, and then it's your heart feels like it's being squeezed, and then you're like, fuck yeah. And then all the time you're like, but someone did like that, so I guess I'm right. And it's this never ending thing, but that's what this industry is truly weeding out the weak of can you handle the goddamn bullshit every day that it throws at you. And then you you pitch and you pitch and you pitch and you pitch, and then one thing hits and you're like, okay.
Right.
Yeah. But I have a good friend of mine who directed a big TV show. I'll tell you afterward because I don't want to blow up her spot. Mm-hmm. But she literally directed this huge TV show. It's just walking off a huge TV show. And she's like, dude, where are my fucking managers and reps? No one's offering me anything. What the fuck? I am in my fucking mode, right? I'm peaking. Where is everyone? And they're like, oh, it's coming, whatever. And it's like, how are you going to walk off the biggest show on TV? Literally, I'll tell you afterward, I'm maybe giving away too much, but and then just be waiting for a phone call.
Yeah.
It's you are the hot shit director right now. Why? And it's but that's this fucking industry.
I've thought about that a lot. I haven't had that moment at all, but I think about that a lot and how I'm we can't do it for the accolades, or mm-hmm. we can't do it mm-hmm. for the titles and the things we could get. We legit have to do this shit, be creative and do the things because we legit love it.
Yeah.
And if it's 100%. For any other reason, when it doesn't work out, it will crush us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100%. That's the same. That's how I feel about award shows, because at the end of the day, you're seeking validation from like a white institution with people that don't actually want to see you. Like, why do we crave that? Why do we need or seek that out? It really bums me out. And yeah, the whole thing that you were saying about the young comment, I totally feel that, especially with the pandemic and all these like 17-year-old TikTokers making more money than I can ever dream of.
But
I mean, it's different for, obviously, as a Black man.
They're
going to
be like 45
year.
And be like, oh my God, why did I post that?
Why did I buy all those Maseratis?
I mean, they'll be rich enough that they won't fucking care. That's what I think.
I mean, but
I hope they're buying the services of money managers. I really, that's what I hope for the TikTokers that are blowing up right now.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, I can only speculate like the trauma of experiencing last year as a Black person. So I'm just glad you're being productive and creative, and I'm just happy to see that along the way and help in whatever way I can. And you're just the best. Your energy is always like every meeting we had, this podcast just like makes me happy. So I wish you all the success.
Oh, same to you guys. I appreciate y'all.
Yeah.
I like this operation you guys got going on.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we let you go, tell the audience where they can find you on the internet if you want to be found.
Yeah.
If you want to be
found. Find me on the FBI's Most Wanted list. I'm number 2. I'm coming for that number 1 spot. I don't know who's on that number 1 spot. No, I'm on Instagram, eric.kay.owusu, and then on Twitter, @owusukid. And then I have some art online in an online portfolio. erickwameowusu.cravado.com, and I can like write that and send it to you or whatever.
Yeah, we'll put it in the description too. So please check out his art and look in the show notes. Please follow him too. He's very funny. And this has been a delight. This is Ethnically Ambiguous. It's Ethnically Amb, A-M-B on Twitter, and Ethnically Ambig, A-M-B-I-G on Instagram. I'm Shireen. It's Shirohiro on Instagram and Shirohiro666 on Twitter.
And I'm Ayana Hosni on Twitter, my hell.
Yeah. Well,
I like that.
Guys, I'm back on Twitter. I know you're like, is she suspended? Is she not? I'm back, baby. Yeah, but who knows what'll happen next week? So stay tuned.
Stay tuned. Roller coaster of a time. But until next time, follow Eric and fucking check out his art and survive. That's all you gotta do. All
survive.
Gotta
do. I like it.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye.
Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.